Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let's just quickly have a chat about my new book, which is coming. It's out June the 27th, and I would just adore you all if you could click pre-order now, because I promise you this book is even better than my others. The science of plant-based nutrition is for everyone. It's for people that eat meat and for people that don't. And it's going to help educate you all about the benefits of a plant-based diet. We cover things such as obviously the gut microbiome, the immune system. Should you be worried about plant milk, seed oils, anti-nutrients? Do you need to take omega-3 supplements? There are so many questions, and I basically think that the world of scientific research is just changing at a dizzying pace, and myths and fads are proliferating everywhere. So with the science of plant-based nutrition, you can achieve a plant-packed diet that's right for you. This book is for children all the way up to adults. I hope that it will be in universities again, like the previous one, and schools and libraries. And I've got the most amazing forwards and good praise for it from Deliciously Ella, Joe Wicks, Fern Cotton, and Tim Spector. So if you could head over to Amazon now, hit pre-order on The Science of Plant-Based Nutrition, I promise you won't regret it. Welcome back to season 17 of Food for Thought. It's incredible to be here. My name is Rhiannon Lambert. For everyone that doesn't know, the reason this podcast is so unique is that I myself am a registered nutritionist. So I have two nutritional science degrees, a master practitioner, further diplomas in different areas of nutrition. The Retrition Clinic I founded in 2016. We have some amazing psychologists, dietitians, nutritionists in there to help you with your one-to-one advice. Not forgetting also, if you need any additional support to your diet, we have Retrition Plus, which is formulated for you with the latest scientific research out there. Now, we're here to bring you a fantastic series ahead, full of tons of amazing guests. If you need any extra information, you can find Retrition across all social media platforms, even from TikTok to Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, and of course, you can head over to Amazon and leading bookshops and find any Rhiannon Lambert authored book out there, from The Science of Nutrition to recipe books about pregnancy, and of course, my first baby back in 2017, Renourish. So let's get on to it. Enjoy season 17 of Food for Thought. There is no doubt that TikTok has boomed. It is one of the most popular platforms today. And according to a recent survey, over 50% of respondents said they're more likely to seek out health advice from the internet than from their healthcare professional. And to be honest with you, it's quite a scary statistic, for one that we see in the Retrition Clinic, with the amount of cases of eating disorders rising and various factors. But while some TikTok diets obviously can be harmful, there are some people out there that are trying to break through. And that means this week's Food for Thought, it had to be the incredible Dr. Idris Magal, known as Dr. Ids. He is a trained medical doctor. He has a master's degree in nutritional research and is certified in lifestyle medicine. He helps us dispel, gosh, I mean, this episode is huge. So many diet myths. We've gone into plant milks, we've gone into seed oils, carnivore diets, you name it. We have debunked it today in this episode. And I'm delighted to say that I wrote a foreword for his new book, which is out, called The Saturated Facts. And it's one that I think everybody should make sure they get their hands on. So without a doubt, let's go into the episode, dispel all the myths and the craziness at the moment, and say hi to Dr. Ids.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Oh my goodness, such a pleasure. It's a very, very exciting time for you, I must say. And I think with the rise of misinformation online, this is probably one of the episodes I've been looking forward to the most because, gosh, have I seen the landscape of social media change. And you're a TikTok star. How does that feel?
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, it was my first platform. It's where I started, you know, disseminating health information. So I'm just glad it's got to where it is now and I can share that information on different platforms now as well. And that's how we got in contact. So, yeah.
No, it is. It is. It's. I think it was very, very needed, actually. And I think an authoritative voice that displays information and breaks down the research, because it's not easy making those videos. It's very time consuming. And I think a lot of people don't realize how time consuming it can be to actually break it all down.
People don't realize, but like for every 60 to 90 second video that they see from me takes me around probably 3 hours worth of total time in terms of work. So like people think, oh, you know, why can't you just post more often? And I'm thinking, I'm not just vlogging or like talking about my day. I'm literally trying to give public health advice, right? So you can't willy-nilly blasé give public health advice. Everything has to be thought out. You have to make sure, you know, you peer review everything. You have to, you know, critique everything. If you're correcting something, make sure it's actually the correction that's valid. So yeah, it does take a lot of time. And, you know, thankfully I've tried to balance my work and life, you know, to try and make things work.
Yeah, it's no easy feat. And I think let's start with dissecting some of these nutrition and diet tips. I'd want to know, first of all, I guess, a little bit about how you initially got into looking as a doctor at the world of nutrition, because, of course, it's rife online. I think everybody believes they're an expert these days.
Yeah, no, great question. It actually started before medical school when I have a few family friends who are dietitians, and they set up a kind of AFN certified course, like level 4 course. And basically they knew that I was interested in medicine and fitness. And, you know, I was doing athletics at the time at a high level. And they knew that I was kind of interested in this field anyway. So they came to me and they said, Idris, do you want to help us design the exam questions for our course? I said, yeah, sure. You know, I was having a gap year. So I was like, yeah, sure, why not? So I went through all of the course material, you know, learned everything as it was. And then I designed, you know, about 30 to 40 exam questions for all of the 27 modules they had. So in order to write questions, you have to know the content, right? And then those questions have to then be approved by the AFN. So after those questions got approved, I then realized that, you know, nutrition's very exciting. It's, you know, it's a field that's kind of often downplayed and often kind of looked at in a negative light across other biomedical sciences and across other specialties. So I figured during medical school, was there a way to get greater expertise and greater exposure to nutrition? And thankfully, my university offers a master's of research where you can actually target what area of research you want to go into. And thankfully, we have some of the best, you know, nutritional researchers in Norwich who have done lots of, you know, meta-analyses, control trials on omega-6 fats. You know, they've done stuff on nutritional composition, the food matrix, Ulsa Welch. So luckily, I had exposure to a lot of these fantastic nutrition researchers. And my entire year was spent dissecting nutrition research, conducting my own research trials. And that was a break in between medical school, so between my fourth and fifth years. So that was where kind of my real deep dive into nutrition began. And then, as you know, I've then continued that journey after medical school with lifestyle medicine and board certification and things like that.
And a new book, which we should also mention, I think, The Saturated Facts. It's incredible. And I think it's going to do extremely well.
I hope so. You know, 2 years of very hard work. I remember getting the first message from Penguin. I was actually in the hospital. I was on call. I was getting bleeped left, right, center. And then I got a message and I was like, Penguin Random House, who's that? And then my senior doctor was like, you mean Penguin Random House, the publisher? And I was like, oh, Penguin. And then I remember I was like, take my bleep. I want to talk to them right now. So I talked to them literally on my shift. And I was like, yeah, no, fantastic. Like, let's get started. And then little did I know how stressful and how hard the journey would be. You know, many nights I'd find myself at 5-6 in the morning still writing. And I would have, you know, had to gone to work at like 8 in the morning. It was very, very tough. We're here now. We're finished. I just want to make sure that it gets in the hands of as many people as possible. And we start putting accurate information in the mainstream and hopefully knock off some of those quacks from the top charts, right? Because I'm just fed up of seeing people say, oh, what do you think about this book and this book? And I'm just like, for gosh sake.
It's like banging your head on a brick wall. But you can see how vulnerable the nutrition world and, you know, the narrative online, it impacts people, because everybody wants to improve their health. Everybody eats, therefore it's an emotive subject. And we know there's some people profit. But why do you think the misinformation has got to a peak? Because I have to say, when I saw those diet pills for pasta and whatever that lady was releasing, I had a mini heart attack. I thought, this is probably the worst thing I think I've ever seen in 10 years. Why do you think there's so much misinformation?
Very, very good and complicated question. So I think there are several contributing factors to why misinformation about nutrition is at an all-time high, and it probably is at an all-time high. So number one, which is quite, you know, important to mention first and foremost, is nutrition science is complex, first of all. And the reason I say that is because, you know, coming from a medical background, a biochemical background, pharmaceutical background, you have to understand that when you look at research in pharmaceuticals or drugs or other interventions, it's very easy to determine whether that intervention has a benefit or a negative, right? Because all you have to do is you provide a pill or you provide a surgery or you provide an intervention and you give a placebo or you do something else, right? So you have a control. In nutrition, it's not that simple because, you know, food is something that we have to eat several times a day. So if you're looking at the effects of a single nutrient on a single biomarker in a cohort of thousands of individuals, how do you isolate those effects in the research, right? Now, people who aren't aware of these nuances, they will probably see a research study and they will just take the conclusion at face value and they'll run away and start giving health advice, right? But it's not that simple. We don't consume food in a vacuum. We don't consume iron, you know, B vitamins, protein in a vacuum. There's such a thing called the food matrix, and how different nutrients interact with one another makes things very difficult. And also the fact that so many different lifestyle habits and genetic factors and socio-environmental factors that can affect the health outcome we're looking at, how do you then tease out what's actually happening with the food compared to all the other things happening? That's number one. Number two, the media does not help, right? So media, you know, sensationalist headlines, you know, cherry picking findings from different studies, you know, rodent studies, preliminary findings, headlines, you know, as we've seen recently with the whole, you know, Cheerios could cause infertility. What kind of nonsense headline is that? I can't believe I saw it being
terrifying.
Perpetuated everywhere. And like, sucralose damages your DNA and, like, you know, aspartame causes cancer. Just the fact that headlines are just so prevalent when it comes to nutrition, it makes the journey of combating that misinformation so much harder. Because as we know from a study, I believe in 2018, that looked at Twitter posts and how fast fake and true information spreads, they found that false information can spread up to 6 times faster, right? And when you take a headline or you take a post across multiple different social media platforms, that can just proliferate at an alarming rate, right? Then you have other factors like a lack of, you know, regulatory oversight, right? Nutrition is one of the scientific fields where there is limited regulation on who can call themselves experts, right? Anyone can call themselves a nutrition advisor. Unfortunately, many people across the world call themselves nutritionists without actually being registered nutritionists, right? And people can call themselves health experts, gut health experts, hormone balancing expert. The amount of terms, made up terms I've seen in nutrition is alarming. You do not see that across any other professional field. You don't see people calling themselves engineers when they're not engineers. You don't see people calling themselves pilots when they're not pilots, right? Even doctors, thankfully, we have some level of regulation. But now we've seen, you know, people using honorary doctors and different, you know, chiropractors trying to masquerade as medical doctors, right? So unfortunately, nutrition has so many made-up terms and a lack of regulatory oversight that it allows anyone to perceive themselves or portray themselves as an expert. And then you have the whole issue as, you know, a one-size-fits-all approach. Nutrition's not like that. You have, you know, cultural, emotional connections to food. So people are so heavily invested in how their community does things that no matter what evidence you show them, they will just, you know, they will just believe and affirm that belief and look for any bit of shred of evidence to affirm that belief. And we saw that recently with the Ayurvedic, you know, Dr. Dimple, who I debunked recently. You know, there is absolutely no evidence that consuming fruit, you know, with dairy is going to cause inflammation and it's toxic and it causes, you know, metabolic waste products. Only because it's something that's been done in tradition, she then thinks that no matter what evidence people show me, I'm not going to believe it.
Yeah, and you're looking at traditional values, like you said, religious beliefs, backgrounds, food affects everybody on a different level. But I love the explanations you put there. And the one that particularly stings me, I will say, is the lack of regulation in this field. And it's something I want to launch a petition for. I need to get you involved, but we're going to do a government petition for that this year.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll happily champion that. Voice that out. Because, you know, it absolutely grinds my gears knowing how many videos I get tagged in every single day. It's probably between 200 to 400 videos a day. And the vast majority of them are absolute nonsense. And a large proportion of them are, you know, self-proclaimed experts. I hate it. I really hate it.
I know. The worst is the monetizing. And I think what happens then is you get these people that have these influential voices online, people that are unregulated, that then monetize and sell products off the back of their non-evidence-based claims. And what's even more confusing is people say they're evidence-based but don't actually understand what evidence-based is. So we're going to move on to asking you about glucose monitoring, because I feel like it's one of the, it's like the current, oh, how can I describe it? It's like back when people were protein bar obsessed, I would say this is on a par where suddenly I remember like 5-6 years ago, or maybe it was 10. Gosh, time's slipping with me. But now it's glucose monitoring. I'd love to know your thoughts on it.
Yeah. Okay. So this is something I've done detailed professional style videos on because it isn't that simple. However, for the purpose of this podcast, I will say that the average person does not need to continuously monitor their blood glucose or hyperfixate over transient peaks and troughs in their blood glucose levels. And I'll explain why. Because if you think, or if someone gives the message that a food or a dietary pattern is healthy or unhealthy based on how high your blood glucose goes, then you're actually missing out on many other important biochemical pathways, which I'll explain. So, for example, based on that rationale, if keeping a steady blood glucose is healthier than having a transient spike, then by that rationale, having a block of butter would be healthier than having an apple, right? Because that block of butter would keep a nice steady blood glucose. But the apple, oh no, you might see a little spike and then an hour later it'll start to come down, right? This is so damaging because you don't know what happens to your other biochemical markers when you're hyperfixating on keeping something so steady. You might be overconsuming calories because you're so hyperfixated on fats, right? Because we know fats slow down the release of carbohydrates and they slow down the digestion process. And you might hyperfixate to the point where you could even cause hypoglycemic issues. And if someone's, you know, insulin resistant and their blood glucose regulation is not working optimally, if you keep something so low, where insulin and glucagon aren't even working that properly, then you might even cause lightheaded, you might cause them to faint, you might cause them to, you know, break a bone and have worse problems like seizures, you know, go into coma, and all these other problems, the sheer hyperfixation on transient spikes is not warranted. If you are diagnosed as pre-diabetic or type 2 diabetic, or you're type 1 diabetic, obviously, you know, then yes, you could make an argument for wearing something like a continuous glucose monitor. But actually, in the insulin resistant demographic, I would argue that as long as you incorporate balanced meals, you don't even need to worry. Because as we know from a large systematic review in 22 by Celeste E. Nord, I think, where they looked at over 60 randomized controlled trials that compared a moderate or balanced carbohydrate diet to a very low carbohydrate diet. Now, those carbohydrate-style diets had up to 60% of their energy coming from carbohydrates. 60%, right? If you asked the glucose goddess or, you know, Tim Spector or any one of these other people, what do you think of a diet that's 60% carbohydrates? They'll be like, no, it's going to cook your cells from the inside, and you're going to, you know, that's what causes diabetes. Well, actually, all of the controlled trials that compared 60% carbohydrate to very low, under 5, 10%, they found that both styles of diet were able to induce type 2 diabetes remission, protect against insulin resistance, you know, manage your blood glucose effectively. And it's because you're having balanced diets. It's because you're having lots of fiber. It's because you're having whole grains. It's because you're having polyphenols that actually are protective against, you know, insulin resistance, pancreas overload, right? So we don't need to hyperfixate. If anyone claims that any spike in blood sugar is toxic or poisonous, then they don't understand human physiology. It's as simple as that. No.
And the problem's arisen here where something that potentially could have been quite a cool experiment for people to do has turned into a public health sort of measure and initiative. And that's where we've lost perspective that everyone's unique again, of course, because not everybody, as you said, and one thing we see in the nutrition clinic, obviously I have clinicians that work in eating disorders, which is a different ballgame completely, but we find a lot of people that are actually worried about fasting because these types of programs encourage fasting and encourage you to participate in certain ways, which equally fasting can be very dangerous for some people. And it definitely doesn't suit everyone. We have people coming in with the shakes. They can't think clearly. They're exposing themselves, like you said, to chronic low blood sugar. And it's dangerous.
Mm. The alarming statistic that I've unfortunately come aware of is, you know, I think something like 9% of Americans at some point in their life will have an eating disorder. That's like 30 million people, right? And that's only those who are living. And unfortunately, since COVID and health anxiety and, you know, people being locked up and, you know, glued to their homes, it's only increasing. And now we see the whole fear-mongering around individual nutrients, around, you know, normal physiological responses. I fear that it's only going to get worse. And as a doctor that's actually worked in inpatient eating disorder units and worked in psychiatry for many months, it is alarming. These people are even scared to have a single cornflake. And their BMIs are under 10, right? It's very dangerous.
Yeah, they manifest in various shapes, sizes. There's so many different spectrums of them. And they are serious. And a lot of people, like you said, don't realize they have disordered eating. It may not be a classified eating disorder, but because of the health anxiety and because of the overexposure to the media they're consuming. And there's also research that when we just pick up our phone and scroll or we see something like, oh, I don't know, the latest trend that we should be doing, it spikes our cortisol. We have physiological stress when we look at social media. But let's discuss seed oils as another topic, because I know you love busting this one. And I had a go on a podcast in a very brief way. Wow, was I trolled for it. I was not expecting the response.
Really?
My goodness me. That gets people going. For some reason, it's a very emotive topic, the oil that you cook with.
Yeah, no, this is probably the leading, you know, nutrition and health myth of the last 18 months, maybe even 2 years. The amount of times I've had to debunk this, and unfortunately, no matter how many times I debunk it, because the amount of people that are spreading this myth is extrapolating at an exponential rate, unfortunately, I'm like swimming upstream. It's just impossible. So this idea that seed oils are just universally bad for everyone at all times in every situation comes from several different thought processes. So you have to break them down individually. So the first one, which is an obvious one, is the appeal to nature fallacy, right? They say, well, seeds don't produce oils. You have to press them, and you've got to treat them, and you've got to put hexane on them and all these other nonsense things, right? And the appeal to nature fallacy can be dismantled very, very quickly. For example, you know, heavy metals are natural. They're found in nature, right? Venom is found in nature, right? Do you want to consume lots of arsenic? Do you want to consume parasites? Parasites are natural. Why don't you consume food that's got parasites in it, right? Yeah. Mold. Why don't you let food go moldy and consume that because it's natural, right?
Yeah.
So like the idea that natural is better is a very silly one. Now, when you get the kind of pseudo intellectuals that actually try to cite evidence, they now start thinking and talking about something called arachidonic acid. Now, arachidonic acid.
Oh my goodness, don't.
Yeah. So the hypothesis that the main omega-6 fat linoleic acid is converted into arachidonic acid, and this is then involved in various inflammatory pathways, which we do know from medicine, it is involved in inflammatory pathways. However, this falls on its face in several places. So the body doesn't convert much linoleic acid into arachidonic acid because the process is very inefficient. And in the small amounts that it actually does, arachidonic acid acts as both a pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory mediator in many different pathways. And we know this because bucket loads of data shows that when you increase linoleic acid by 500% or you decrease it by 90%, that has no effect on arachidonic acid levels in the plasma or tissue. Okay? So you know changing how much linoleic acid you consume has no effect on arachidonic acid. That's number one. Number two, a meta-analysis of 83 randomized control trials done by my old research methods lecturer, Lee Hooper, in Norwich, on humans that looked at patients with IBD or without IBD, that's inflammatory bowel disease for those who aren't aware, and they looked at whether you increase total polyunsaturated fats, omega-3 or omega-6s, those variables had no impact on circulating inflammatory markers or the risk of disease. So now we know from 83 control trials, not one, 83, we know that seed oils or omega-6s, the omega-6 component of seed oils is not inherently inflammatory. Now, you have to remember that seed oils aren't totally comprised of omega-6s. Some seed oils are only 20, 30% omega-6 fats, right? The other things are obviously going to be, you know, MUFAs, as we call them, monounsaturated fats, and even a little bit of saturated fats, right? Now, if you want to figure out how a fat or how a food affects someone's health, you can't look at an individual component like omega-6. You have to look at the total food. You have to look at all of the ingredients in that food and how it affects health. Well, fortunately enough, we have meta-analyses on canola oil of over 40 randomized control trials showing it significantly improves cardiometabolic markers like LDL cholesterol, apolipoprotein B, total cholesterol. We have meta-analyses showing it doesn't increase circulating inflammatory markers.
And for people confused, sorry, Idris, for people confused, canola's rapeseed, for people that don't know over here, because it's often a term in America that is used on packets, and over here you will just see it written down as rapeseed or...
Yeah, rapeseed, canola. So obviously when you buy like vegetable oils, like if you actually look at what's in them, some will have sunflower, some will have rapeseed, some will have a mix of both, right? Even sesame, all these kind of things. So it's just this notion that omega-6 is just universally bad is absolutely absurd. There is no controlled human evidence even alluding to that idea. And even independently funded, you know, research trials, I always get hit with the, oh, you must be funded by big rapeseed. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what are you talking about? Where's my check?
I'd had one. I know. I didn't even get a free oil.
Yeah. I would absolutely love to be paid for giving accurate evidence-based information.
Yeah.
And you would also find that the main proponents of this narrative, funnily enough, come from the animal-based or carnivore-based or, you know, natural is better kind of people that have that rhetoric, right? And they just, no matter how much evidence you show them, their bias, their internal bias, and the fact that they've built their following on this idea that natural and animal is better, they won't change their mind because they're so embedded in this way of thinking.
It's really scary for people because it's confusing. And I think there's often, we're going to get on this almost so much. The problem with nutrition is when you're discussing one area like we're doing with not as much time as obviously you could spend hours just talking about seed oils and about omega-6. But the omega-6, omega-3 ratio is something, like you said, a lot of people try and dish out online. But actually, it's probably the thing that's going to do you more harm for anyone listening. It's not the consumption of the oil itself. It's probably just over consuming your McDonald's. You know, it's your ultra processed foods that contain more omega-6 and don't have the beneficial monounsaturated fatty acids, things that you want in your diet. And we have to look at the diet on a whole rather than the 2% of seed oil that might be in your plant milk. Let's do plant milks because oat milk is just, I don't get when it became, I don't think oat milk never tried to be this superior healthy item. It's just a delicious drink and everyone has blown it way out of proportion. Go for it, oat milk.
Yeah, no, interestingly, it's so funny, you know, even Oatly, the company Oatly, right? They saw how much nonsense their company was getting and they literally directly messaged me on Instagram. They were like, Dr. Ids, please, I know you've you know, debunked someone talking crap about Oatly before. I would love to do a video with you again, basically saying the same thing. I was like, sure. Like, if you want to pay me to debunk the same myth I've debunked already, why not, right? And, like, why they're getting so much slack, I have no idea, right? People say,
I
like...
I feel bad for them.
Yeah, same. I know their profits are hurting right now. Like, I know for a fact. Like, and the issue is, like, people... they look to the idea that oats, number one, are inherently not healthy to begin with. So the glucose goddess says this, you know, Coach Jeremy says this. There are people that genuinely think that oatmeal or oats are just not healthy to begin with, first of all. They also think that, you know, the tiny residues of glyphosate, which is, you know, Roundup, which is a type of pesticide, herbicide used in largely in America, the tiny residues that are remain on these crops, they can cause damage, which is just absolutely ridiculous. You'd have to eat hundreds of servings of these foods every single day before you even reach minuscule amounts, right? So that's just a ridiculous myth to begin with. Then you've got the idea that oat milk, you know, causes a massive spike in blood glucose. And then we go back to this whole fear-mongering over transient rises in blood glucose. That's also an issue. And then... they also don't realize or they don't even acknowledge that many plant-based milks like oat milks are often fortified with lots of beneficial things.
Yeah.
Right? Vitamin D, like calcium, you know, various minerals.
You have to have oil to do that.
Yes, yes, exactly, right? And I just think it all comes back to this appeal to nature fallacy because once again, they go, oh, you know, you can't milk an oat, you can't milk an almond. Ha 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 ha, I'm so funny. Let's just demonize any plant-based alternative. I find it very pseudo-intellectual. It's very lazy. It's very kind of superficial in their messaging. Like any real academic would just see straight past it. And unfortunately, because the lay person, the average person, is not a trained academic, then, you know, it relies on people like us to have to constantly dispel these damaging myths because, you know, not everyone can drink milk, right? I get major upset if I have some milk, right? Like, and even in this oats that I've got right here, I've got almond milk. I'm not scared of no almond milk. Like, it's just ridiculous.
No, but I think you're right. And there are, I see two camps online. Obviously, you've got people that, quite rightly so, if that's their ethical choice, don't want to consume cow's milk, which is fair enough. There's a whole other subject of the farming industry in the world right now and the impact on the environment. That's a whole other area. And as a mother now myself, I see things differently when it comes to milk. But, you know, if you're looking at the choice you're making, nutritionally speaking, plant milks just taste nice and people have fortified them to help you. They are not inherently bad. Hi guys, just a quick moment of your time to introduce to you all my new Retrition Plus children's vitamin D drops. Now these are carefully crafted. You know, I've got children myself with your little ones in mind, and the easy to use child-friendly drops are designed, of course, with a vegan vitamin D3 to support normal bones, muscles and teeth. These drops aren't just easy to take because, you know, I put them in a milk bottle or I can put them in water. They can take them as they are in their mouth, whatever's easiest for your child. But, you know, we make it an ultimate health hero for your children. We ensure that they're going to grow up strong and healthy. It's our top priority, let's be honest. And it's recommended by the government that children take vitamin D drops. If you guys want to find out more about Retrition Plus, head over to retritionplus.com and you can browse all of the products that we've created and find one that's right for you. My commitment and the team's commitment to health goes way beyond just providing quality supplements. I believe in transparency, sustainability, and a responsible approach to well-being. So Retrition Plus is essentially like your partner, I suppose, in achieving a healthier and more balanced you. We are rooted in science. We are focused on you. Be sure if you want to sign up, of course, to our newsletter via the website, and make sure you follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Retrition Plus so you are up to date with the latest products and science-based information. Now, I feel like you touched on carnivore. I feel like this is an intense episode, by the way, guys, but I want to really, don't want to use a pun, but milk Dr. Ids for all he's worth on this episode right now. So carnivore diets. Now, I've had a run-in with these people my whole career, to be honest, because obviously I say fiber is beneficial for your health and your gut. And I've said that from day one of my university training. However, there is a school of thought out there that eating only meat and fat is enough to sustain a healthy lifestyle. And I'm going to say everyone's unique, but it's quite angry. It's an angry corner of the internet, and it's profitable because people then sell their powders. Don't know what you think about it.
Yeah. I mean, well, speaking about profit, you know, we saw what happened with Liver King. You know, he was making 100 million plus a year just on his animal-based supplements, just on his supplements alone, right? And that obviously all stemmed from, oh, big alpha male, steroid-infused gym bro, you can look like this if you eat this way. And then he turned out to be a charlatan. And obviously, we knew he was a charlatan, but he turned out to be a lying scam artist, basically. So obviously we know that corner of the internet is very, you know, persuasive, is very angry. It's very dominated by alpha gym bros who think that, you know, how you look is a reflection of your internal health. And once again, this is lazy science as well. I will say that everyone is different. However, one thing that will always be universally true is that a healthful dietary pattern will never exclude all plant-based foods.
That's just
a universal truth. No matter how different you are, you're still human and you still abide by our metabolic processes, right? Now, the reason why it's gained so much popularity in recent years is because people are conflating and they're assimilating how you feel with how your health status is. This is a very, very important point. Because when people have been used to consuming an ultra-processed Western-style diet, right, their gut and their gut microbiota and the specific composition of their bacterial species may not be in the most optimal state. Now, when it's not in an optimal state, if they just start to increase the amount of plant fibers they're consuming, that's obviously going to cause some problems. You're going to get a bit of bloating. You might get a bit of constipation, a bit of diarrhea. You might feel uneasy. You might feel a little bit lethargic. That's because you haven't cultivated the internal environment to actually deal with these plant fibers. Now, when people have tried just massively shooting up their, you know, plant-based foods, because apparently that's what's healthy, they then go, you know what? I've tried this. That hasn't worked. I feel worse. Let me try going carnivore. Now, when you do the most extreme form of elimination diet, which is what we do in clinical practice, right? Of course, you're going to feel better temporarily because you're not consuming any fiber. Your gut has a chance to rest, right? You're alleviating some of that bloating, some of that gastrointestinal pain. people think that because you're relieving some gastrointestinal symptoms, my health must be so much better. That is not what's happening. The idea of an elimination diet is to slowly reintroduce foods you were not able to consume and you were intolerant to beforehand. Now, the reason why you have to do that is because several reasons. One, you may feel great, but can you feel cancerous cells or precancerous cells developing in your colon? No, you can't. Can you feel atherosclerosis building up in your arteries? No, you can't. Can you feel your liver depositing intrahepatic triglycerides and spilling over into visceral fat? No, you can't. You can't feel these things. They are things that manifest over decades. So your short-term relief does not equal long-term health. So I think purely for this reason, the carnivore diet trend is going to be possibly the most dangerous dietary fad we've seen in the last 10, 20 years. And people are only going to see the downsides in a decade or two, right? That's why it's so damaging. It's so universally damaging. And I know people from the carnivore space, they love anecdotes, right? They go, yeah, I feel so much better. I reverse my diabetes. Well, here's one anecdote. You know, there's a guy called Michael Riley, right, who was called the carnivore kid on Twitter, right? A few years ago, he explained his journey that he went carnivore for 5-6 years straight, right? Now, he was found to have a left anterior descending artery, one of the main arteries around your heart. He was found to have that blocked by 95%, 95% blockage, and he was a young man, a young fit man with a six-pack, right? And that was going carnivore after five, six years. And you know what they call that artery? They call that artery the widowmaker because it kills. When it gets blocked, you're finished. Luckily, they had to do a, you know, triple bypass surgery, I believe. And they had to, you know, get rid of the blockage and basically fix him before he died, quite frankly. 95%, any moment after that, he could have just dropped dead from a massive MI. And the left anterior descending artery supplies the majority of the heart, right? It's the one that basically kills you. So, you know, if you want to speak about anecdote, there are plenty of anecdotes. There's a health page online called The Carnivore Cringe or Carnivore Cringe on Instagram. And they post, I think, every day, like a negative effect from someone going carnivore. So I just think, you know, people assimilate or they equivalate how they feel with their health. Yeah. And that's just not what we should be doing.
It's psychology and food all over again. I mean, I've known it my whole career, but it's so heavily intertwined and people just cling on to it. And what should also be a huge red flag is a lot of these people, you know, you mentioned Liver King, but alongside their carnivore regime, they sell you things. They sell you their miracle. They sell you extra fat, which I find just blows my mind. They sell extra fat to add to coffees, and then they sell collagen peptide thing. They sell everything, and then they make loads of money. They don't know. And what makes me almost sad is that, first of all, they shouldn't be given a platform to voice this absurdity anyway. But the second point is they genuinely believe it. And what's very, very difficult is someone that wholeheartedly believes what they're doing is beneficial for their health. They don't see the damage, like you said, 6 years later, 10 years later. Moving on from carnivore, before I go into our questions from our followers, because there's just so much to discuss, I think I really want to touch quickly on calories, because it was huge. I mean, it was really huge. I'd say pre-COVID, again, people got numbers obsessed. And I think now the message that it's not just numbers is getting out there, but almost we've gone too far. There has to be an understanding of calculations as an estimation, but why calorie counting probably isn't enough to help anybody lose body fat if that's what they want to do. I don't know if you have a take-home message for people on calories.
I think, you know, some form of, you know, self-accountability, whether it comes from, you know, food diaries, calorie counting, you know, even doing limb measurements, waist measurements, you know, daily scale weights, whatever. You need some form of holding yourself accountable and to figure out trends and your, you know, downfalls in your day-to-day eating habits. I think, you know, the evidence is very clear on that. Some form of self-accountability However that manifests is up to you. Now, you know, calorie counting is difficult for even trained professionals, right? There was a study that I cite in my book, actually, where they, I think, looked at 10 qualified registered dietitians. And even when they were taught how to weigh food, they couldn't calorie count within a 200 calorie range. They were still more than 200 calories off. Yeah. And they're trained registered dietitians, right? So if they're not going to be able to accurately calorie count, what hope does the average person have? Now, that being said, that doesn't mean that it's completely useless, because even if you're off by 400 calories a day, right, but you consistently are off by 400 calories a day, you will still learn trends about your health, right? Because you will still learn that if I'm decreasing it, what happens? Is my weight decreasing, right? If I maintain similar meal time, similar meal compositions, you know, do I eat the same thing for lunch every day? Do I have, you know, one of three meals every day for dinner? A lot of people are creatures of habit, so they will often have similar foods every week. Now, if you're tracking, even if it is wrong, you should learn some data about your total calories if you consistently do it. Now, is it necessary to lose weight? No, of course it's not necessary. The most important thing is obviously, you know, focusing on minimally processed foods to the best of your ability. And don't forget, you know, things like canned foods, frozen fruits and vegetables, pulses, frozen. A lot of cheaper packaged foods are also minimally processed, to be fair. People need to understand that it doesn't have to be super expensive. You don't have to get organic, fresh produce for everything you consume, right? I think as long as you're focusing on the main principles of a healthful dietary pattern, which is, you know, largely plant-based. Obviously, I eat a lot of meat, but I'm not going to lie and say that all the data does show that if the majority of your diet is plant-based in nature, fruits and vegetables, nuts, seeds, legumes, and obviously fatty fish is very good for you. You know, low-fat dairy is very good for you. Cheese, yogurts, and the occasional red meat is absolutely fine. Leaner the better, with lower levels of saturated fat is better, obviously. As long as you follow some of the main dietary principles, then you actually don't need to calorie count. Calorie counting is more for people that have like specific athletic goals, endurance-based goals, like people that have, you know, competitions, who are in high elite level, you know, bodybuilding. In that demographic, it makes more sense. I do have personal clients and patients who do love calorie counting. They love it because it holds them accountable. You know, they haven't developed a disordered relationship with food. They're very aware that if they want to eat a slice of cake, they can. They just have to track it, right? And there's nothing wrong with it. I think we don't have to polarize methods of holding ourselves accountable. There's no universal bad method. There's no universal good method. It's more about adherence and consistency and focusing on key dietary principles.
And understanding the whole picture. I think if you have a basic understanding of energy, I like to call calories energy for our clients. And like you said, sports nutrition is not public health nutrition. I find myself saying that a lot because sports nutrition is a calculated method. You know, on the packets on the shop shelves, it can be 30% inaccurate in itself on the calorie, you know, the calorie guide. So what you're calculating isn't accurate anyway. But if it does hold you accountable, it works for some, it doesn't work for others. We have questions for you from our listeners. And actually, let's start with this because you're a doctor. John has said, is AI going to be bad for doctors and spreading bad information? I don't know why AI, actually, that's thrown me a little bit. But I like the fact there are doctors out there spreading misinformation as well.
Of course. Yeah, of course. And I've publicly corrected them as well. So yeah. This is a very interesting one because just like any advancement in medicine and technology, it can be used very well or very poorly, right? It can be used for good, or it can be used for evil, right? That's the case with anything. I think AI can help us doctors a lot. For example, we're seeing it already in radiology, where, you know, AI is being rolled out to help, you know, radiologists and doctors diagnose conditions that are difficult to see on CT or MRI scans, for example, right? But the problem could arise when people become reliant on AI for their critical thinking. Now, this is a problem because if it leads us to become de-skilled, then that could be dangerous for sure because, you know, the less you do something, the less skilled you become. So one simple example as to how, you know, we use now automated blood pressure machines to check someone's blood pressure, right? Rather than manually checking it with a stethoscope and a cuff. The fact that we can just press a button and it tells us someone's blood pressure shows you that many doctors have now lost the ability to manually check someone's blood pressure, right? So if we become overly reliant on using AI algorithms to assess symptoms, to, you know, investigate a patient, to run blood tests, we then run the risk of becoming de-skilled in areas which you need the human touch, right? No matter how good AI will become, you always need hands-on doctors to actually, you know, examine a patient and to take someone's, you know, symptoms and consideration, feelings into consideration. You know, no matter how good AI is, there will always be the human instincts that will be needed in medicine.
What about emergencies? What about if an emergency happens by the side of the road? You don't have your automatic blood pressure monitor and your kit. You need to use yourself.
And not just that, like AI and technology is designed to not take anything with risk, right? So it tends to trend towards doing the safer option. Now, sometimes the safer option might be the wrong option, because humans, we have an instinct sometimes. If we have a gut feeling, like, for example, when I'm treating a patient in hospital and they're very, very unwell, right? Sometimes I could go with the safer option, but there's also a case to be made for doing something a bit more risky, but it could save their life, right? So like AI algorithms, that they don't opt for the risky thing. Humans sometimes do, and sometimes it pays off. So I think we still need human error. We need human instinct. We need human intelligence involved in the human health space. If we rely on AI too much, we could just end up being another, you know, system on the conveyor belt where we actually don't take into consideration human feelings, human emotions. And that could actually become very bad later.
Oh, it terrifies me. I remember when those programs on BBC Black Mirror came out years ago or something, and they predicted
amazing.
All the weird future events. And now there are these glasses you can walk around with that are filming people. And anyway, that really freaks me out. Dan has said, I've seen anti-bloat pills to help with digestion and bloating. People are selling these to me. And I'm confused about ultra-processed food. So they're the two last questions I think we should get in from listeners.
Fine. So, you know, you have to, once again, you have to scrutinize what exactly you're being, you know, marketed towards and being sold towards. So, you know, anti-bloat pill insinuates that there's going to be some kind of a laxative agent in there. There's going to be some kind of maybe possibly some type of, you know, fiber. There could be some type of, you know, laxative, like people, you know, people these days have been putting, you know, they've been using coffee enemas and like random stuff to make them explode their bowels, right?
Colonics,
and you have to realize, like, yeah, exactly. Like, are these types of supplements going to actually fix the problem, or is it going to be a temporary relief for you? And are you going to become reliant on these temporary reliefs, which you're then only feeding into the wellness industry market because you're now saying, oh yeah, half an hour after I take this, my bloating's gone. Okay, well, have you ever thought about why are you having the bloating in the first place?
In the first place, right?
Do you need to slowly, you know, cultivate your microbiome to the point where it can actually tolerate these foods? Do you need to, you know, keep a food diary and find out which foods exactly are causing you problems? Do you need to get tested from a doctor? You know, go to an allergist test. Don't do food sensitivity tests. I've said it again and again. IgG tests are nonsense. Do not do them, please. Go see an actual allergist. Yes, but people do, right? So anti-bloat pills, like these kind of supplements, yes, they can provide temporary relief, but are you making the problem worse because you're becoming overly reliant on them? And have you looked into the root cause of your bloating? That's what I'll say. And then the second part was...
Ultra-processed foods. I think people are now terrified, to be quite frank with you. Who is it that asked me that? Candice. I think people are just so scared that they think everything now is ultra-processed. I've had clients come to me where their main goal, which is actually quite a healthy one if you think about it, it depends how you look at it, is to reduce their UPFs in their diet, ultra-processed foods.
Yeah. I mean, sure, like, as a general public health recommendation, if you were to reduce your consumption of ultra-processed foods across the board, you will probably see a net improvement in health. Now, does that mean every ultra-processed food is bad? Of course not. You need to, you know, you need to be a bit more critical about these recommendations because, for example, you know, protein supplements are ultra-processed, whey protein is ultra-processed, creatine monohydrate is ultra-processed, fiber one bars or, you know, ultra-processed foods that are fortified, you know,
nutrition
fortified
drinks for patients going through cancer.
Yeah,
or
like ensure, yeah,
them, yeah,
calorie drinks for those who have lost appetite, yeah, in the elderly. You know, preventing cachexia. You know, cachexia kills 30% of patients with cancer. So, like, you can't just say all ultra-processed foods are bad. But if you were to just cut out every single ultra-processed food from your diet, then chances are you will improve your health. But I just don't want people to take that and run away with it and then think all of a sudden, you know, like all ultra-processed foods are harmful, because they're not. You have to look at individual nutrients. I think the main problem with ultra-processed food is that on average, they are less satiating and more tasty than minimally processed foods. That combination makes it very easy to overconsume. And overconsumption of calories is the main problem with ultra-processed foods. It's not really so much about what the nutrient composition is. It's more about, if I have an ultra-processed fruit compote versus a whole apple, which one's going to, you know, satiate me, which one's not? That's really where the main difference lies.
It's really interesting. And I think just for everyone listening, just to not scare you, to reassure you, I think, you know, the stat we've got is 60% of our diets are ultra-processed foods. And that's because what Dr. Riz just said is that, you know, they're moorish. You consume a lot more of them because they're less palatable. But equally, you know, the food matrix disappears. You know, you're grinding down, you're using carrot powder instead of a carrot. It just changes the whole way of how we look at food, how we digest and how we consume it. And then for some people, gut health's irritated by emulsifiers, preservatives, but we have to extend shelf life. So, you know, you've got to look at food in a different way. We are now moving on to our fact or fiction round. Are you ready?
Okay, you hit me. I'm ready.
As if you haven't delivered enough, I'm going to put you on the spot for a speedy round.
Sure.
Here we go. Red meat causes colon cancer.
Red meat increases the risk of colon cancer, particularly due to things like heme iron, heterocyclic amines, other harmful compounds in the cooking process. The effects on the microbiome, for example, increases in, you know, bile tolerant organisms that, you know, promote pro-inflammatory bacterial species. For those reasons and those mechanisms, there is a consistent and strong relationship between red meat and an increased risk of colorectal and colon cancer.
Perfect. Weight in the midsection is due to high cortisol levels.
It's one of the causes of excess waist circumference and excess visceral fat. And that's because various glucocorticoids like cortisol can actually cause a redistribution of fat stores from other parts of your body towards the midsection. And this is one of the reasons. It's not the only reason. For example, living a sedentary life and consuming excess saturated fats, which spills over from the liver into the intra-abdominal region. You also have things like consuming excess refined sugars can increase intrahepatic triglycerides by 33%. In a study in 2018. Alcohol, of course, because of its damaging effect on the liver. Also, levels of androgens, testosterone, you know, having healthy amounts of testosterone in men and also women is obviously protective from visceral fat levels. So cortisol is one of the reasons, but being stressed from work is not going to cause you to have a big belly.
Thank goodness. I know, because that's my main cause of stress. Soy is bad for men's libido. This is a funny one.
Yeah, this is absolute garbage. Catherine E. Reed et al. In 2021 conducted a meta-analysis of over 40 randomized control trials that showed isoflavone extracts or soy protein or soy products do not adversely affect Male sex hormones, done.
Thank goodness, yep. A high-fiber diet may reduce your risk of various cancers, including colorectal, gastric, pancreatic, and breast cancer.
Yeah, very good one. This could actually require a 30-minute talk, but I'll summarize it quickly. Because it is true, it does reduce the risk of various cancers, but you have to understand why, and there are multiple reasons for it. One of them is that it obviously helps manage your weight, and having a high fiber diet reduces the likelihood of you becoming obese, and obesity can increase various up to 13 different cancers by 100 to 400%. So that's number one mechanism. Number two, it promotes a healthy gut microbiota and promotes bacterial species that produce something called short chain fatty acids like butyrate. And these can protect against cancer forming and can also reduce the amount of mutations that happen in your gut. That's another mechanism. Number three, there are plenty of mechanisms, but I'll just give another one. Number three, it can also help normalize insulin levels and manage your blood glucose levels. And we know that chronic hyperinsulinemia is a potential mechanism in the pathway of several different types of cancers.
Yeah, exactly. Guys, your diet matters. A vegan diet will cure type 2 diabetes.
I mean, this one's a very reductionist kind of phrasing because, you know, any diet can be done very poorly or very well. I can literally give you a vegan diet plan that will increase your risk of type 2 diabetes.
Yes.
And I can give you one that will decrease it. So, you know, if it's comprised of, you know, ultra-processed loaded vegan burgers and sauces with fries and super calorific sauces and meat substitutes, then, you know, it probably won't send your diabetes into remission. But if it's a diet rich in whole grains, phytonutrients from berries, you know, dark leafy greens, lots of high protein plant-based foods like legumes, tofu, beans, seitan, then yes, you probably can get into remission with a vegan diet. Just depends how you do it.
Exactly. We should avoid peanut butter because they contain hydrogenated oils.
So hydrogenated oils, you have to specify, do we mean fully hydrogenated? Do we mean partially hydrogenated? Because partially hydrogenated, you know, they've been heavily discouraged in the food supply in the US, the UK, and they've been banned in the US. Yes. Yeah. And they've been banned in the US anyway. So like they are the worst kind of fats. So we're not really talking about partially hydrogenated oils. When you talk about fully hydrogenated oils, of course, like, you know, peanut butter is high in calories. It's got a little bit of saturated fat. It contains a good amount of unsaturated fat and protein. So it's not necessary to avoid it. Just be mindful of total calories. It's very calorific. That's the thing that's going to be more harmful to you than any composition of these hydrogenated versus, you know, not hydrogenated oils. So just bear in mind that you shouldn't be having like 3-4 tablespoons a day because that's like 400 calories. Right.
And that's very hard, isn't it?
You should just,
so good.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I will say I used to, when I was actually actively gaining weight, I used to finish a 2,500 calorie jar in 4 days. And I used to buy about 10 jars at a time purely because I find it so hard to gain weight. Right.
Yeah.
So I was adding boatloads to my protein smoothies and it helped me gain weight. But I've realized it's not a sensible long-term strategy.
It's expensive long-term strategy as well.
Yeah, there it is, yeah.
Guys, I should have also said in that question, the word maybe used trans fats, people may have heard of more than me talking about the oils there. Dark chocolate increases stem cells.
Yeah, good one. I actually did a video on this with Dr. William Lee, where he talked about this study. It was a study done in 2010 by Christian Heiss, I believe. And they took, I think, 16 patients with coronary artery disease and they fed them dark chocolate drinks with high amounts of flavanols and polyphenols. And they saw a decrease in blood pressure, which is great. They saw an increase in something called circulating angiogenic cells, which are a type of stem cell, by 100%. Which are important for vascular repair and endothelial function. And we think that that improvement in endothelial function was the mechanism by which their blood pressure improved. So that's only one tiny study. Like, I'm not going to get, you know, caught up on it, But there is some evidence to suggest it does increase stem cells. But I will say that dark chocolate contains lots of other beneficial things that is a reason to consume it anyway.
I didn't know that, you know. It's actually caused me reason to think my hot chocolate habit is actually quite a beneficial one, because I do use the 85%.
Yeah, for real. That will actually be a very good habit to have, because as long as you're not consuming an entire bar of dark chocolate a day, like having a few squares
or
having a dark chocolate drink.
I love it.
Amazing. Yeah. The antioxidant activity in dark chocolate is even higher than things like blueberries.
Love it.
So
love it. I knew there was a reason for my chocolate habit. and finally, eggs are a great source of protein and may be protective for hypertension and stroke and has no effect on inflammatory markers.
Oh, very difficult, because you have to think about... So once again, eggs are a great source of protein, of course. They do contain lots of nutrients, lots of vitamins, lots of beneficial things. However, you have to think about, one, how are you consuming it? How are you cooking it, right? Are you having fried eggs? Are you having poached eggs? Are you having steamed? Are you having scrambled? Are you adding things... Yeah, are you having omelets, right, with lots of vegetables in it? Number two, what is it replacing in your diet? I can't answer this question, you know, does it have any protective effect for hypertension, diabetes? Because you have to look at, when you run substitution analyses in observational trials, what is it replacing? Is it, if it's replacing refined grains and, you know, like large amounts of fatty meats, then yes, you will probably find a protective effect. But if you're reducing your amount of tofu consumption and legumes and nuts, and then you're consuming three eggs in place of that, it probably won't be protective. And there's some evidence it could even increase your risk of diabetes, right? So like, you have to look at, what are you replacing in the diet? Only then can you make an informed discussion, or can you actually start to discuss whether it's protective against inflammatory markers or not. It's too simple-minded to like just say, are eggs protective?
Do you know what? That's lovely. Thank you for that fact or fiction round. I think it's a really good way to wrap up the podcast, because we always finish with a food for thought. And I think the messaging that one food equates to this health outcome is just so minimalist. And there's lots of scary words out there for everyone listening about foods causing inflammation and foods being bad for you. And I even heard somebody say that vegetables were cancerous the other day. I've literally heard it all. Yes. Yeah, you see, you laugh. You see, this is just it. I was thinking, what on earth is this lady going on about now? But she was genuinely convinced in her outlook. And I can see everyone listening. I know it's awful. I know it's really, really, really confusing. And the people that are not lying to you are the ones that aren't selling you one-size-fits-all approaches. And we don't have the answer for everybody listening, because we don't know you and your unique requirements. Equally, it's so complex. So my take-home message that I would start with as a food for thought is, put your detective hat on always and just think about what you can add in. I know it's such a boring thing, but if you don't have dark chocolates and you want something yummy, like I have my hot chocolate every day, that's not bad for you if it's a small portion of dark chocolate every day in your hot chocolate. Why not just try and add an extra apple instead of buying a pack of ready-prepped fruit salad in a load of syrup? You know, it's little swaps. Dr. Idris, we need to go there. What's your take-home message after that huge discussion that you could give everyone a food for thought?
Oh, yeah. My take-home message was probably, be skeptical of what you see and hear online. And, you know, make sure you have a few kind of filtering systems, mental filtering systems in place to allow you to be a bit more diligent and critical of what you see and hear. Don't just resort to, because I feel anxious and scared now by what someone said, you know, does that mean it's the truth, right? Hopefully from this discussion, you'll realize that myths are vast and they are perpetuated in every corner of the internet, right? And because 60% of us go to social media and the internet for various parts of health advice, we just have to be a bit more critical and understand that just because someone's saying something, even professionals, you can't just believe it at face value. You have to start developing some level of, you know, filtering system. And hopefully from my content and what we've discussed today, you'll start to realize that things are a bit more nuanced, a bit more complex than what they're made out to be.
Exactly. And on that note, where can people go to find out more about you? And of course, I would highly recommend everyone to purchase Saturated Facts. And it's rare I say that, but it's a brilliant myth-busting book. And if you want everything broken down that we've actually discussed in this conversation today and more, in more depth, it's brilliant. You know, Idris has got a whole chapter on the different oils, seed oils. It's all written down, so you can go back to it, you can bookmark it, and it's a brilliant book. But where can people go to learn more about you?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm just Dr_Ids on, you know, most social media platforms, TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook. And if people are interested in, you know, higher level research breakdowns, I have a members forum for that. And I obviously, in my book, I'd thoroughly appreciate all your guys' support. It lets, you know, retailers know that there's a demand for it. And hopefully we can, you know, dethrone some of these quack authors that just constantly fill my feeds with some actual sensible advice.
Yeah, here's hoping. It's Dr. Ids, thank you so, so much for coming on Food for Thought today.
Thank you for having me. I've had a lovely conversation.
Right, that's it. If you're enjoying Food for Thought, you will love what we have coming up in future episodes, I have no doubt. So if you're not already, you just have to hit the subscribe button on your podcast app. So this means you get a little notification bell. I wish I'd known about it earlier. There is a lot of misinformation out there, and I really hope that we're continuing to bring you the latest research along with our special guests to ensure that you're just getting the best experience possible. So if you are enjoying our episodes and you're learning lots, then please do leave us a review or get in touch. This will help enormously and ultimately help us reach more people and make sure we're doing the right thing by you and giving you the right information. So if you want to learn more about the best-selling books, the clinic, perhaps you need to book in to see one of our fantastic clinicians, or to find out more about Retrition Plus, you can find everything you need to know on retrition.com. And you can follow, of course, me on Retrition on all social media platforms. Yes, I'm even on TikTok now, guys. So you can head over there and check it out.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.